Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. And we're here with our friend. I can call you a friend, right?
Sure.
Michael Lenihan, the author of Much Ado, A Summer of the Repertory Theater Company. That's the one in Spring Green, Wisconsin. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
And I know you through social content, but you did that book, was it 2013, for Loyola, Ramblers Loyola, Chicago, 1963, The Team That Changed the Color of College Basketball. And that was for the same publisher.
Yes.
And this is your follow-up.
I guess you could look at it that way.
And tell us first about the basketball book. You know, we did see Ron Baker. Remember Ron Baker? He's displaced Derrick Rose on the Knicks when Ron played for Wichita State. When we went to the Wichita State
really?
Game. Yeah, you had that fuzzy look. Like, what's he talking about?
Yeah. I guess I wasn't paying too much attention.
Yeah. But tell us first about the basketball book.
Well, the Loyola, you know, I lived in Chicago. I've been living in Chicago for about 35 years. I didn't grow up here, but I used to live up in Rogers Park, and I'd take the L downtown to work every day, and I'd go past that Loyola Fieldhouse and the 1963 championship plaque or banner or whatever you want to call it there. And, you know, it's something that all Chicago, red-blooded Chicago males knew about. That Loyola had won the NCAA championship in 1963. But there's a lot to the story that a lot of people didn't know about. And I became aware of it when I saw a little feature on the team on Channel 11. Seeing this, I became aware that there was a civil rights and racial dimension to the story, I went looking for a book to read about it. I was sure there must be one, but there wasn't. And so I started thinking about, well, maybe I could keep myself busy running this down. So I started to contact the players, most of whom are still alive and eager to tell their story. And, you know, one thing led to another. It took me about 3 years, and I put it together. I found out in the process, I mentioned that there was a racial dimension to the story. Loyola was one of the few teams in 1963 that was starting four black players. Most coaches were reluctant to do this. Their student bodies were mostly white. Their alumni were all white.
George Ireland, the coach?
George Ireland was the coach at Loyola, and he was one of the few coaches at the time who went against the grain. You know, they used to say the rule was you can play three blacks if you're home, two if you're on the – no, how did it go? You can play two blacks at home, one if you're away, three if you're way behind. That was the joke that they used to tell. But George Ireland, who was having trouble living up to the proud basketball tradition that had been established at Loyola, it was bumping along at a little less than 500 record, he decided to go where the basketball players were do it his way, which was just, you know, put the best players he could find on the floor. So he went to New York and scouted the he had a guy, actually, who was scouting the playgrounds in New York for him. He went to Nashville, where there was a big high school basketball, national basketball tournament every year. And George Ireland and a few other coaches, but a very few, recognized that this was a gathering of some really top-flight and mostly neglected basketball talent, because most of these guys could not get scholarships. You know, Oscar Robertson can get a scholarship. Wilt Chamberlain could. But if you were a merely really good player, nobody wanted you because nobody wanted too many blacks in the team picture. So George Ireland went where the players were. He recruited his team. And in 1963, he had a team that was made up of two guys from New York, two guys from Nashville, and one Irish Catholic kid from Chicago, from Marquette Park, Jack Egan. And they were a running fast break team. They were the highest scoring team in the country, and they were they turns out that they were the team of destiny. They played in the final, they played University of Cincinnati, which was another team that started a lot of black players. They had three black starters that year. And the year before, they had had four. So when people tuned into this game, and this was one of the first, this was the first game in the first long-term TV contract that the NCAA tournament ever had. You know, I think they spent $750,000 on it or something like that, if memory serves, you know, a drop in the bucket compared to what they buy the rights for today. But when people tuned into that game, they saw something that you and I would take for granted. But at that time, in the words of one of the Cincinnati players, was a scene to make your eyes pop out of your head. Seven of the 10 guys on the floor were black. And a lot of people, and especially my book, maintains that this was one of the turning points in collegiate basketball. One of the reasons that coaches started opening up to more black players.
That's right. That's why I wanted to bring the book into the conversation. Is some books have short shelf lives, but this book is important, and people still can find it, and it still is relevant. You know, people need to read this. It's Chicago history. It's American history.
Well, thank you for saying that. Yeah. I think people should read it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It is available.
Yeah, and the publisher again is
Agate Midway.
Agate Midway, and so what? Now, when I heard about this, the book about the theater company, you know, I knew your Loyola book. This was quite different. So, how'd you go from the basketball to Much Ado?
Well,
it's a fine looking book too. It's very very well designed.
Yes. All credit to Agate Midway for that.
Yeah.
I had nothing to do with it. You know what it's like to be a feature writer or a magazine writer. Well, I was a magazine writer for almost my whole career, and you know, you just bump from one subject to another. And you know, people ask me, you know, I'm at a party, someone says, "Oh, you're a writer. What do you write about?" I never know how to answer them. You know, usually I say, "I'm a journalist," and they're happy with that. But if they press any farther, I don't know what I, you know. And the real answer is, I write about what I'm curious about and what interests me. And I hope that my curiosity and the interest that I have in the subject will translate, and other readers and readers will be interested in it too.
But let me ask you this, as you cultivate audience, like the books I'm doing, I'm kind of in this niche now where we do these little travel Americana books.
Yeah.
You know what? So, I mean, we did supper clubs, we did the soul food and civil rights, and now we're doing campers. And, so in terms of marketing, does that make any difference to you when you change gears?
Like you're that? Way ahead of me on the marketing curve. I can see that. No, you know, the only audience I'm cultivating is, my friends and family and whoever else I can persuade to buy the
book. Well, you're too modest. I mean, I know you from The Reader. What was your title at The Reader?
I had every title at The Reader, but I was the executive editor and the editor-in-chief. And
of the Chicago Reader?
Yes.
Yeah.
So
pre-Michael Farrow.
I believe so, yes, yes.
But now I'm going to ask you about the beekeeping story, and then I want to go into deconstruction, which leads back to the book. But like you did the beekeeping story for The Reader.
Yes.
Tell the listeners about the beekeeping.
You know, it was I saw something in the Tribune, one paragraph thing about a guy who had bees on his roof on Armitage Avenue. And I thought, that sounds interesting. And there was a guy, I was working at Encyclopedia Britannica at the time, writing science films, if you can believe it. And we had this science guy there who was a really good teacher. And we started talking about bees, and he started telling me all these interesting things about bees. Like, you know, if you want to get in the hive, you have to blow smoke in the hive. Why does that calm the bees? Well, because the bees think the hive is on fire. and they gorge themselves on honey because they're like preparing for an emergency. And then they slow down.
Only on Nocturnal Journal do you hear that. Yeah.
So he was full of stuff like this. So I put this, you know, there's all these arcane bits of knowledge about bees. And there's this guy with a beehive up on his roof over a furniture store on Armitage in Sheffield or some, you know, someplace like that. Nobody knows it's there. Who ever heard of such a thing? I hadn't. You know, now it's a little more common, more commonly known. So, again, you know, your writer's mind, your gears just start going, well, that seems interesting. There must be something there. And
yeah, that's and in Much Ado, you're just curious about how things work. You were telling me that a couple of weeks ago. Just so you really embedded yourselves with the theater company and just really, really wanted to figure out the dynamics and how things work.
Yeah.
Like with the bees.
That's the way it usually goes for me. I try to embed myself in the situation, spend a lot of time hanging around and watching and so forth. And this was really ideal situation. The people at the theater company were very welcoming. You know, by the second or third week, I was as familiar a face as any of the others. It was like I was part of the company almost. And so I got to see the real nitty-gritty, and I got to see a lot of stuff that I never imagined from sitting in the audience.
Well, tell me about the process. You'd been going up to Spring Green since the early 80s. You had this idea once before.
Right. The company was founded in 1979. They put on their first show in 1980.
And tell the listeners what it, I mean, is it all outdoors?
Not now. It started all outdoors in this beautiful place called Spring Green, Wisconsin, a very small town, but Frank Lloyd Wright's Taliesin is there. It's a little bit kind of arty for the middle of Wisconsin. And these young theater people, especially a classically trained actor named Randall Duck Kim, who was sort of a genius, he gathered this bunch of people around him in Spring Green, and they had very high ideals and ambitions. They were going to create a classical theater company for the whole country, and that's why it has this highfalutin name, American Players Theater. Mm-hmm. But at the time, in the early 80s, the company was quite young. I was a kind of young writer. I was looking for something to do, and I had the experience that a lot of people have when they go to this theater, and a lot of people have the first time they see Shakespeare done really well. It's a surprise. You know, you read Shakespeare in school. It's kind of difficult. Now I know that reading is not the way you get Shakespeare. The way you get it is to have talented actors do it for you. And the first time you see that, it's like a revelation. Like, oh, Shakespeare, who knew? So I had this experience, and I thought it would be, this is 30 years ago, mm-hmm. like you say, I thought it would be fun to hang out with this theater company and watch what they do and see how they make the magic is the terminology I always use for it. So I talked to the founders of the company, and they were, you know, it was a young company. They were struggling financially. They didn't want me around, but I guess I must have filed the idea away, because 30 years later, I went on a backstage tour at the theater, and all these
with Travis
memories,
Knight.
Travis Knight. You sounds know
like,
Travis.
Well, it just sounds like a good basketball name.
Well, he's kind of tall. Yeah. He's a very fine physical specimen. If you're listening, Travis, we'll settle up later. I don't know if he's plays basketball, yeah. But he was the ghost of Christmas. I think he was two of the ghosts in the Goodman Christmas Carol this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. A Chicago guy, like a lot of these APT people are, they work up there in the summer and work around Chicago in the winter. Anyway, he was a great storyteller. He took us on this tour, and all of my memories came back to me from 30 years ago. And it seemed to me, you know, there's got to be a story there. And this time I was more mature. The company was more mature, and we managed to get together, and they let me in. And I had a great time, you know, probably more fun than I ever had researching a story.
Yeah, you say that. You never had more fun researching a story. Is it, I mean, how much of this stuff, had you gone to theater a lot over the last 30 years? I mean, how much of this did you have to learn? I mean, coming into something kind of cold would be kind of intimidating for me. But, I mean, was this kind of in your wheelhouse, or was it an all new thing for
you? No, you know, like I'm saying, the life of at least my career as a magazine writer is going into one thing after another that I often don't know anything about.
Yeah.
One of the reviewers of this book, one of my compatriots in the alternative press, thanks a lot, friends, someone who has no respect for history or for her elders, complained that I didn't know, and I admitted in the book that I didn't know what a stage manager does exactly. This is how ignorant I was about theater. And, you know, I have to plead guilty. But that's my gig. You know, I go into a situation not knowing a whole lot more than you do. I learn what I can. That's the part that I think I'm good at. And I tell you what I learned. And if, you know, your level of ignorance and my level of ignorance are a rough match for each other, then we have the basis of a good relationship, a reader and writer.
Chapter Woman in a Red Dress. For Bob Morgan, who designed the costumes as well as the set, the first scene was all important. In the theater, he told me, first impressions are even more powerful than in real life. Make a mistake here and the character might never recover. Hero is a girl, innocent, expectant, and a vision of such beauty that Claudio falls for her immediately. Patricia, on the other hand, must be a woman, formidable, smart, experienced, skeptical about the simplicity of young love. All this needs to be said in an instant, without words.
That's what a costume designer does.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of stuff in the theater that's like that. You know, the lights, the costumes, the music, all of this stuff contributes to meaning in a way that you can begin to appreciate when you see how the people work at it, and you have a chance to, you know, when I have a chance to say, well, why, how come a red dress? And this guy can go on and on, as you can see. Why he picked red and what kind of shade of red he wanted and where he got it from. And that's his life.
Kind of an Andy Rooney type. like really getting down the deal. But, I mean, what's interesting about this is, and I think you point this out, is their process is invisible. And you have to convey that to the reader. What they're doing is kind of the whole process of putting this together is kind of an...
Well, you know, there's so much that... And this is one of my big premises... there's just so much that goes into it that you don't see as a member of the audience. I mean, you it affects you, but not in ways that you're conscious of until you get backstage and start seeing how the pieces fit together.
Now, when you go to, when did you finish the book?
Oh, I guess I finished it in the maybe spring of 15. The season ended in November of 2014, so maybe the summer or fall of 15.
And the book came out?
October of 2016.
So when you go to theater now, is there something you pick up on and something you see that you didn't know before you did the book?
I don't know if I will – one of the things I'll do now is go back to a show a few times and – one of the things that I know to look for now is to see the subtle ways in which it changes. Sometimes not so subtle ways. You know, they solve problems. They did this version of Much Ado 27 times, you know, and they're working on it the whole time, and they're changing things and fine-tuning it as they go. So I know to look for that. Other than that, I don't know if I pick up a lot more than you would, but I do have a lot of... appreciation for how much went into it. And I do have a better idea of where things come from, which is one of the things I was most curious about. You know, you have the Shakespeare text, he gives almost no stage directions. So because he wasn't writing for publication, he was right there. If he wanted you to smack your forehead, he'd say, when you say that, smack your forehead, because they were putting the play together on the spot. So there's no stage directions there. So, you know, the words are coming from Shakespeare. The movements, the inflections, the interpretation of the words, I now have a little better idea of where those things come from than I would, than I ever did before. I always assumed that the director sort of hatches the whole meaning, and he just tells the actors, you know, I want you to, here's your motivation, you know. Yeah. They're always, here's the way you should inflect this scene and so forth. I learned that the actors have a much more active role, at least in this company, have a much more active role. So many of the big moments in this production were created not by the director and not by Shakespeare, but by the actors, the way they delivered the lines and the, you know, what they put into it.
You know, I'm circling back to the way we began the segment with the basketball book, with the Loyola basketball book. And I, as you heard in the previous segment with Rich and I love playing sports into real life situations. But was there anything, as you did this book and did the researching and went there, that made you think about the basketball book? And I'm talking about teamwork. I'm talking about trust. I'm talking about just living together and getting along together. Was there anything that you all of a sudden popped into your head?
Yes, and you put your finger on the most important things, I think, that trust and the living together, which breeds the trust. And, you know, I learned from doing this Loyola book. You know, I'm not really a basketball guy any more than I am a theater guy. So I was kind of going in, learning what I could learn. And I learned a lot about what athletes mean when they say, when they talk about trust. You know, there's the moment of the big basket in the big championship game. You know, Les Hunter comes down with the rebound, and he knows exactly where Ron Miller is going to be. And he makes the outlet pass, and so it's that familiarity with each other, you know, the practice or the rehearsal, so that they know what to expect of each other, and the trust to let each individual on the team or each member of the cast do his or her thing, and you know, the idea that I do my part and I trust the next guy to do his part. And that's very important. And it's one of the things that I think is that contributes to the specialness of APT, or American Players Theater, I keep calling it APT, is that these actors, a lot of them have been working together for 15 years, sometimes longer. And they know each other well. And so they have that trust and that closeness and that familiarity with each other.
Okay, well, thank you. Thanks for coming in. Much Ado, A Summer with a Repertory Theater Company, Michael Lenihan. And how can people find the book?
Anywhere. If your indie, if your local store doesn't have it, they can get it for you. And, of course, you can get it on all of the online places.
And the Loyola basketball book, too.
That one, too.
Same publisher. It's Agate Midway.
Agate Midway from Evanston.
Okay, Michael. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks
for having me, Dave. I always remember we saw Ron Baker play for Wichita State. And he caused Derrick Rose all that trouble.